I'd like to begin our podcast by respectfully acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast and pay our respects to the elders past and present. We recognise and honour their ongoing connection to land, waters, culture and community. We extend that respect to all Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people listening in today. Welcome to the Australian Chiropractors Association National Podcast, where we explore the ideas, the people and the purpose shaping the future of chiropractic in Australia. I'm your podcast host, Dr. Kim Lee-Jong. Today's conversation sits right at the intersection of something we're all seeing more in practice, persistent musculoskeletal pain. Not just the physical presentation, but the deeper layers that the beliefs, the behaviours, the emotional load that so often travels with it. As chiropractors, we've always played a central role in helping people move better, function better, and live better. But there's an evolving conversation happening within our profession and cross healthcare at the moment, more broadly around how we truly bring a approach to life in everyday practice. While this concept isn't new, the application itself, well, you know, that's where the challenge lies. In today's episode, we're going to dive into emerging model of care that looks at bridging that gap, integrating digitally supported, psychologically informed pain management alongside what we already do in clinical practice. This conversation is about expanding the chiropractic toolbox without losing the heart of what we do. So let's get into this. I'm really excited for this episode today because I get to bring on a very important guest. As part of the National Spinal Health Week month, the Australian Chiropractic Association has released the results of a research undertaken by Dr. David McNaughton, which focused on examining the coexistence of back pain and mental health conditions in patients. Just a little bit of a background about Dr. McNaughton. Dr. David McNaughton is a clinician, academic, a chiropractor, and senior lecturer at CQ University, where he teaches and researches at the intersection of musculoskeletal health, psychology, and healthcare innovation. Alongside academia, David directs a multidisciplinary allied health practice, bringing real-world clinical insights into his work. His research focuses on pain, mental health, burnout, and integrating psychologically informed care into musculoskeletal practice with a strong passion for advancing patient-centered healthcare. David, welcome. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kim. Very, very much appreciate the introduction and the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, your research, congratulations on the research, firstly. Well done. The research, which is titled Adding an Online Psychologically Informed Pain Management Program to Routine Musculoskeletal Care in Australia, has produced some really interesting results. Firstly, we probably both agree that pretty much musculoskeletal pain is one of the biggest burdens in our healthcare system. So have the results of your study been able to identify what might be missing in the way of back pain and how it's currently managed?
Yeah, great question. And you're right, musculoskeletal care, and particularly chronic musculoskeletal care, is incredibly prevalent in society and impacts patients and also costs the health system quite a lot of money. The complexity around this is back pain can be caused not only by a number of things, but it can also be influenced by a number of things as well. So there's no one silver bullet to help all back pain. Yeah. And particularly when you get into chronic symptoms, the complexity just kind of adds another layer through there. So with our research, it's really about disentangling that complexity of psychological factors, social factors, and the biological factors. And then at the same time, having a practical way to address that in clinic, which is where the study is going somehow. Mm-hmm.
Okay, fantastic. Now, we also know that this idea of integrating a biopsychosocial approach has been around for a long time now. Why do you think it's still not consistently, showing up in everyday practice?
Yeah, great question. This is one of the main reasons for doing this research. It's a valid question as well. The biopsychosocial model's been around since the 70s, and we're still struggling to integrate it in. And it was a key point in my thesis around this. I can spend a lot of time talking about this, but realistically, the biopsychosocial model is quite vague in its expression.
I see.
It's not a bad thing. It's a nice framework. It gives you a good understanding that, hey, if you're sad, you might get more pain, and if you're in pain, you might get sad. That relates to anxiety and stress, or how your social situation or your workplace situation may impact your experience. And that all relates with pain and posture and inflammation as well. So from a framework perspective, it's very helpful. It provides patients an understanding that it's not just the disc, it's not just the muscle.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more broader than that. The difficulty in the model, which I found over time, is that it's a bit too vague in that it goes too broad and there's not a lot of actionable steps that can be taken around that.
I see.
And clinicians particularly just need a little bit more help in integrating some of these principles further. So that's probably one reason that I believe and I suspect that there's been some difficulty in it. And then also some hesitancy as well, where some clinicians may feel that this is outside their scope or we're focusing on one area. So there's probably a number of reasons across this as well, but yes.
Like most things, there's probably a number of reasons, just like the patient itself who actually has the problem, a number of reasons may have brought upon that the problem.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it makes sense. Now, from the clinical application and I guess the reality of it all really, there seems to be a little bit of tension between hands-on care, quote-unquote, and these broader conversations that we're just starting to have. How are clinicians navigating that without losing, I guess, their identity or patient trust?
Yeah, it's a great question. From the study, we kind of went into both the patient's perspectives of what they expect from a chiropractor in terms of these sort of things, and then also the clinician's, you know, predefined scope of what they think they should be doing in this sort of thing. And they're really, really interesting questions to kind of work around. I think from a patient's perspective, patients want to feel better.
Yeah.
They do have expectations of what they think they're getting with care, but at the same time, your responsibility as the clinician is to provide options that you think, you know, may help their symptoms. And when you add in other therapies or you add in other, you know, ideas like psychological concepts, it's adjunct, it's synergistic, it's additive, it's not replacing anything. Sure. It's just making it more holistic and appreciating different perspectives around why the symptoms are there. Also from a clinician's perspective their professional identity as well. I think, as I said, this is additive. It's not replacing anything.
Sure.
Just providing a more comprehensive component to it.
I love that because it means that the clinicians get an opportunity to dissect the case together as opposed to one trying to, you know, navigate the whole thing by themselves. That collaborative approach is really good.
Correct.
So I'm really welcoming the fact that this study was done. So fantastic. In terms of the practitioner's perspective, what does psychologically informed care, quote unquote, actually look like in a chiropractic office? How would you integrate that per se?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of literature around this. There's a lot of literature on what it is. I think at a very basic level, as a clinician and obviously academic background in psychology, it's conversations.
Okay.
You're having conversations with patients around how psychosocial factors can influence their symptoms. At the very basic. And just explaining some very simple concepts like the biopsychosocial model.
Yeah.
You know, I often spend time in clinical practice. I've got a nice place to draw and I talk through people's symptoms and I go, hey, you've spoken about your pain and your posture and inflammation. That's important. You've spoken about, you know, you've got a history of stress, work's really suffering, you know, family life's a bit tough at the moment. And I go, look, these are not separate things.
Yeah.
You know, often I say to patients, you know, we're incredibly complex beings and what else is happening in the ecosystem around us will influence us and how we experience symptoms. So I think from a very basic point, from a psychologically informed care perspective from a clinician, it's just starting to have these conversations.
Yeah.
You can start to take that further in terms of integrating specific conversations and integrating specific things like activity pacing, goal setting, you know, challenging unhelpful thoughts.
Yeah.
These are all key aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy directly related to pain. But I think before you get into
the complexity
or even trying to try some simple aspects or simple types of psychological therapy, it's just having a conversation with the patient around this is important, these are the factors that could be involved, and are you open to exploring this?
I guess giving them that understanding, sometimes they lose perspective of exactly where they're at with their chronic pain, and that we as individuals and organism is very, we're really dynamic. And so there are a lot of things that, like you just touched on, can hugely influence and drive their position in their symptomatology, right?
Correct. And, you know, I think our role as a clinician is to guide somewhat. It's not necessarily, you know, always, you know, you do is what I say. Like it's your role is to guide in areas where you believe, you know, and the evidence supports that this will be beneficial for your symptoms. But it's a very, at all times, it's a collaborative approach and you're kind of working with the patient at that point.
Fantastic. Love that. In terms of the patient behavior and engagement, we know that persistent musculoskeletal pain is, you know, pretty much frequently associated with poor psychological outcomes. What did the study reveal about the types of patients who are most ready to engage with this kind of care? What did that come through in
and
the,
this
the study?
This is a great question. And a main part of this study was to really have an understanding of what types of patients would this potentially work for. And that has important kind of implications for, you know, designing bigger quality, you know, effectiveness trials. So there's very methodological approaches around eligibility. But also having a greater understanding of, you know, who does this work for? Who wants to do this type stuff? Makes sense. I think having a good understanding that, you know, like what we said in the beginning, there's never going to be a silver bullet where one thing is going to help everyone. And people have different perspectives on things, and people are more open than others to different things. So we found, it seems circular, but people being open to different things. And I think you do come across patients that are very, no, I want this, this is all I want, and this is what I want to do. You have other patients, depending on where they are in their symptom journey, can be much more open. Other people go, no, I'm just going to get the operation. The operation's going to help me. So, and this is in part is a framing of how a clinician frames things. And I think clinicians have quite a lot of power in these consults in a good way. Like, you know, and we talk about this idea of a warm handover. So if I go to you, there's this program. It's okay. Like, you know, the psychologists, I think, are involved. That it might get some benefit. Versus, hey, I work closely with this program. There's strong engagement. There's good data. Really great people work on this. And I really think it might be beneficial for your symptoms in addition to what we're doing. So the clinician here plays a really, really powerful role on this idea of a warm handover. Particularly if they don't have a lot of experience with psychology or counselling in the past.
I think one of the big things that you touched on there, and if I can read it correctly, is the word trust. The trust in the clinician from the patient's perspective, and then being able to engage in that once they have that trust in the clinician.
The key, there was a key quote that came out of the qualitative findings in this research, which almost, you know, it's my research, so I'm biased. I'm biased anyway, so I think it's always great. But it really cemented where we're going with this sort of stuff. And one of the quotes was, you know, I had this conversation with this was a patient who ended up doing the course and ended up doing and benefiting from the MindSpot course. Goes, I really appreciated the clinician. If they didn't provide me the opportunity or recommend this, I probably wouldn't have done it. The clinician here can play quite a central role to opening up a patient's perspective into different ideas of where they can manage their symptoms better. So it really just cemented that obviously the patient needs to be open to things, but the clinician plays a really, really
key role
in getting them open as well.
And gaining that trust.
And the trust in that therapeutic alliance is just completely central to all that. If that's not there, it's hard to do anything, to be honest.
True.
But definitely when trying to recommend different perspectives and different alternatives or additional things, I think it's really, really critical.
So we touched on the word trust there in terms of the clinician and the practitioner. What would be a great referral conversation? So if a person was thinking, but you know how there's that case sometimes when a person sits there and they go, I don't know if I shouldn't, you know, is this going to help? So what would be a great referral conversation so to get that person across the line to engage in that and you know, potentially get rid of their issues for once for all?
Yeah, great question. As well, this did come up as well in particularly in some of the clinician interviews, because we looked at, you know, how clinicians actually had these conversations.
Yeah.
And it was a topic. We was like, you know, we're going to recommend this to patients.
Yeah.
How do clinicians actually introduce this into their clinical practice?
Yeah.
Again, it's a bit dependent on the patient. As I said, some patients are really open to this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's you don't really need much convincing. I think this is going to be beneficial. Here you go. You know, and again, this is coming back another quote that's in the paper, is sometimes these conversations take a year of planting seeds.
Wow.
So behavior change, and really at the core of what we're talking about is behavior change.
Yep.
Incredibly difficult to do. Humans are quite complex, and trying to get the, you know, marketers and that sort of stuff do very well, but it's very subtle. And but at the core, what we're talking about is behavior change here, and getting someone to do something that we think will benefit their symptoms. Sometimes that just does take time.
Yeah.
And not expecting that this will happen straight away.
Yeah.
I think it's really important, having the conversation first, and gauging openness and how much we can kind of go back and forth with this conversation, and providing resources around that as well to let the patient make their own decision.
Yeah. Because ultimately it's
their decision.
Correct.
And to be honest, and most outcomes with interventions, if a patient doesn't think they're going to get a benefit from it or doesn't want to do it,
it doesn't matter what
they're probably not going to get better with it.
It doesn't matter what you give them, right? It doesn't matter what you do for them.
So there needs to be that internal motivation to give this a go and immerse themselves in these kind of processes, and then they generally get the best outcomes from that sort of stuff. So I would say it's not a quick thing like a lot of behavior change. It's for some patients it can be more easy, other patients can be more difficult.
Sure.
But I think allowing yourself to have the conversations and allow the conversations over time. I always, you know, more positive, a bit more kind of optimistic that a consistent positive message over time.
Yeah. Planting that seed and then you're continually feeding that, and it'll grow.
Have you thought about it? No. Oh, do you want some more resources? Cool. Okay. I think it might work. You know, it doesn't need to be a hard push or anything like that. But the conversation needs to be there, and just, consistent positive
message. Yeah, we touched on that. So my next question is, we said time. So we're looking at barriers. Okay, barriers from that you have came across from the study itself. Time pressure, you mentioned, emotional load and confidence all came up as barriers, I'm assuming, within the study. You sort of touched on all of them. What needs to change to get better support from that space?
This is great. This, you know, and you can almost, and this is, again, this is from an implementation science perspective, trying to understand, you know, if we deploy some of these programs, does it work, and how well it works, and what barriers. So from a scientific methodological perspective, it's very important. You know, if I can frame things somewhat simply in that there's patient clinician level barriers. And then there's also system level barriers as well. So, you know, practice and either broader systems, like, but time pressures and, you know, busy clinical life, you know, we see this across, and we see it a lot in general practice as well, is that, you know, when you have tight consults and lots of people waiting, and as I said, these are conversations that take time and sometimes
you can't
get this done in 5 minutes, these conversations.
Exactly.
So there are structural time pressures that do occur. How you as a practitioner overcome that can be different in different practices. There's resources available. I often generally spend a bit of time in the beginning, more time in the beginning.
Establishing
these concepts and, you know, then providing resources and checking back in. And it's not like a big, heavy a heavy conversation every time. It's just like, oh, how are you going with that? Have you read the resources I sent? So there's more of that kind of lots of a little instead of one big thing.
Just to help with it.
But time is in a busy clinical practice, it's a barrier for a lot of things.
Sure.
Confidence, you know, clinician confidence is another clinician level factor, we would say. Mm-hmm.
You mean confidence as in certainty within the clinician itself?
Yeah, so confidence as in confidence, and this is very broad, confidence in their ability to have these conversations.
Okay.
Confidence in the actual intervention that they're referring to. Mm-hmm, so there's confidence around those sort of things. So we found some clinicians, you know, if they didn't have a good understanding and really want to understand what are they actually referring to and what's involved, you know, all of a sudden they had a better way and they were more confident in actually providing that information to patients. But also at the same time, confidence around discussing psychological concepts. And and this is where we're working and going to be looking at more research in kind of upskilling clinicians and just going, here are some scripts, here are some kind of tools and resources you can use to help have these conversations in practice as well.
And not make it too awkward.
And not exactly, but, you know, and that's the thing. If you've never done this sort of stuff before, it can be quite daunting. And that's where we kind of felt some of these confidence issues. And if they're not really from a basic level, from a confidence, if people are not confident in doing something, they're probably not going to do it.
Yeah, understandable. So.
And the last thing that you touched on was the emotional toll. And this was a very novel thing that we found in the study, which was interesting. It hasn't come up hugely in the literature a lot, was around the emotional toll that this takes on clinicians. So, you know, what we do, we work with pain a lot as clinicians. You know, we work with, you know, complexity of patients' lives and it's, if you're a clinician, you understand it's emotional.
Like, exactly. You take on the load.
There is a lot there. You have a busy clinical day talking to a lot of conversations and, you know, if some of those conversations are quite heavy. Like you need to be reflective of your own self.
Correct.
Psychology do this very well.
Yep.
Psychologists, clinical psychologists, they're very, very conscious of clinician well-being, very, very conscious of their own personal cup per se.
Yep.
And they're aware if they're not good, it's not good for the patient as well. And this is an example of these conversations discussing psychological concepts and how stress and anxiety and pain can, you know, and sometimes there's quite heavy things that go on in people's lives that impact their symptoms. It takes an emotional toll.
Yeah.
So I think clinicians being really more mindful of their own clinical and clinician well-being. This is very self-reflective, and there's, I think this is something that as a profession we can do more of. As I said, clinical psychologists and psychologists, very structured supervision models, very, very structured check-ins, being very self-reflective of their own feelings, emotions, and thoughts and behaviors, and how that potentially comes out in clinical consults.
Yeah.
So I think the emotional toll part, I think there's some work to be done here in supporting clinicians on how to take care of their own well-being.
Well, I dare say that would be reasonably new within our profession. I've been a chiropractor for 30 years now, and I have seen the effect of practitioners and clinicians taking on too much and then becoming almost symptomatic, like the people that they're actually looking after.
Yes.
So yeah. So that's a very, very
and this patient group as well is particularly.
Yes.
You know, this isn't the rolled ankle or the these are conversations that these symptoms are impacting people's lives.
Yeah.
They're ongoing. Mm-hmm. Complete symptom resolution is sometimes not clear and not you know
able
or especially in the short term, and having quite these difficult conversations around, you know, shifting from resolution to management, you know, okay, some life stuff's really going on, let's kind of help you here. These are can be difficult conversations if you're not in the right headspace as well.
Okay. Well, that really opens up, obviously, for more studies, right? More studies that would embrace that aspect, that emotional load on the clinician as well, because that's significant. If they're the ones that's guiding the patient's outcome, they need themselves to be well as well, right?
It's the old thing with clinicians, like you need to be able to, you know, you yourself need to be good.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where you get the best outcomes.
Exactly, 100%. Your study results, if we look at it from the perspective of moving forwards with it. Your study results highlighted the need to target education as one, streamline referral processes, which we just touched on, and supportive practice environments to enhance digital adaptation. So looking ahead, do you see models like this reshaping the future of chiropractic and musculoskeletal healthcare in Australia?
Yeah, definitely. I think Australia can be quite world-leading in a lot of these sort of spaces. Yep. We've got really good research capability and I think there's lots of opportunity there. I will say that, again, like back pain, there's no, and I, again, very biased, I love my model of care that we're developing in this, you know, digitally supported psychological care. There are a number of other models of care as well where it's mainly clinician-led. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some, you know, physiotherapists and chiros doing psychological therapy. Yep. There's some psychologists doing more physical, there's lots of these models of care around. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, no one model is going to be absolutely perfect, mm-hmm. and be all for everyone. Yeah,
like your silver bullet quote.
Yeah. Same thing with the silver bullet quote. Mm. But having different models for different people,
correct,
at different times will help things. Yeah. The beauty that I like about this model of care, where it's relatively, you know, we do talk about clinician training and getting them more confident in these sort of things, but it's relatively more light touch than other, you know, really intensive training programs and that sort of stuff. And the other thing as well, these digitally supported, I think embracing this kind of digital supported movement, it really helps for rural and regional components. And underserved populations where access to psychology and some of these multidisciplinary services
are not available.
It's, you know, you're going to go hours or 100Ks to see a psychologist. You know, so, and then also a costs component to a lot of these sort of things as well. So why I like working particularly with MindSpot and this chronic online pain management program is that it's free. Access is, you just need internet access, and you can kind of streamline this into the clinic quite easily. I like saying you've got your own little psychologist in the clinic, it's not necessarily about, you know, increasing the clinician's capability to provide all these different services. We're just streamlining interdisciplinary collaboration. So we have the clinician and the chiropractor doing the physical stuff really well, and hey, we've got a really strong pain management program which can kind of tail in, which is freely available and accessible. But again, I'll also say some patients want to see a psychologist in person. Patients want to they don't want the digital side of things. So we need to accommodate for that as well.
Sure. But we're talking on the whole, majority wise, that's a fantastic option for those who are restricted, whether it be by time, whether it be by space, whether it be by, you know, area that they're living in. So that's a fantastic option for them.
Correct.
Well, David, congratulations again on your research. You should be biased. I think it's a fantastic outcome. And thank you for your time. I really appreciate your time and sharing the insights of your study.
Beautiful. Thank you, Kim. I really appreciate this. And
not at all. Really, and I do appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man. There's a clear message emerging from today's discussion, one that feels both familiar and forward-looking. Persistent musculoskeletal pain isn't just about what we do with our hands, as David's alluded to. It's about how we connect, how we communicate, and how we support people understanding their own health journey. What we're explored today is not a replacement, as David's rightly said, for chiropractic care, but an extension of it, a model that recognises that some patients need some more understanding, some more support, even some more tools to navigate the complexity of the persistent pain. And more importantly, it reminds us that trust remains the centre of everything. There are, of course, as David and I have sort of discussed today, challenges in the way of time, capacity, confidence in navigating these conversations, but I'm sure within those challenges are opportunities for growth, for collaboration, and for basically continuing to evolve our profession as a whole. As chiropractors, we've always adapted. We've always had led in a very conservative, patient-centered care model, and conversations like this are a part of that ongoing evolution. So thank you again, and I can't stress enough. Thank you so much for David and his time and discussing his paper. Thank you for joining us at the ACA podcast. And as always, I always say, keep showing up, everybody. Keep learning and keep making a difference. Until next time, see ya.